Hi, this is Dave. Welcome. Today I'm joined by Emmett Peppers, and we're going to have a session to talk about Tesla stock price, Bitcoin, Doge, and a bunch of other topics that come up. Just want to welcome you back, Emmett. How are you doing?
Good. Very good, Dave. Yeah. Happy awesome. To chat about whatever we can come up with.
Yeah. So I heard you just came back from camping. How was that with your family?
Yeah, it was great. It was the first time my kids ever went camping, and we were off the grid, and it was tough sleeping in the tent. We didn't bring like any mattresses or anything. We're sleeping on sleeping bags on these kind of like rocky floors. But you know, the kids loved it. We went with a few other families and their kids, and there was like 10 kids all under the age of like 10. And between 5 and 10 years old, and they just had a blast, and we're all friends, and the parents, we all kind of hung out and had a good time. So it was incredible. Yeah, we'll do it again.
How many nights did you go?
Just 2 nights. Yeah, 3 days and 2 nights. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I suggest always bring the mat. You know, like,
yeah.
So like, at least you get some comfort. And did you bring at least earplugs and like eye mask or anything? Or
I did. Okay. Bring earplugs and an eye mask. That was helpful for me. Yeah. And I had just 2 weeks prior gone on a white water rafting trip with just a few other dads I know. So it was cool. Like that was a three night one, I think. And we went down a big river and camped on the side of it a couple of times. Yeah. And it was really cool. But so I thought I was a pro at camping after that. And then it's a whole nother thing when you're bringing your kids though. It's,
yeah, definitely.
And you got to cook for yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. About a week and a half ago. So we were traveling, and then we're at the Grand Canyon, and we're supposed to spend a week at the Grand Canyon because my kids just absolutely love that place. And after one night, I was doing a YouTube video. I was recording. My family or my kids and wife were out, and then I was packing up, and I accidentally pushed like this piece of wood into this bear spray can that I have, and it activated the bear spray can and just shot the bear spray like all over inside our RV, which is basically pepper spray. It's like pepper spray, right?
Oh, no.
And I was just like all crying, and I'm like, oh my gosh, what happened? And I was trying to clean it up, but our RV was like still like had bear spray all over it. And so we spent like the whole afternoon cleaning up. And then just to be safe, we stayed at a hotel instead of the RV that night. cut the trip short.
Oh my gosh!
All this stuff. But I mean,
now, why do you have bear spray? Are there actual bears near where you go camping that you have to like, defend yourself from?
It's a combination where we have had to kind of carry bear spray, like especially up north, like Glacier National Park and other.
That's one of my biggest fears is these black bears.
And they're rare. It's rare, and they don't usually.
It's rare.
Yeah, they're not vicious unless they're protecting their youngsters, but. Yeah, and then also it's like self-protection. We just want something inside, you know, just to quickly get to if we need to. But yeah, that was crazy, man. But I've got some extra. I got some more camping trips coming up in a couple of weeks. So it should be fun, my kids.
Well, yeah, I think everyone should do that sometimes. You know, my wife really didn't want to do it. She came and she enjoyed it. And she hated the sleeping situation too. But ultimately, she was happy she went. And I think everyone should do some camping once in a while. It's hard. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people don't do it at all anymore, but I think a generation ago it was much more common. Yeah.
Or glamping.
Glamping.
Yeah, yeah. Luxury camping. curious, what are your kind of current thoughts on Tesla stock price? I think we're right around 600 right now, kind of, you know, languishing in that range. We have some folks who are kind of getting anxious a bit, complaining about the lack of movement. What are your thoughts about all this?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've talked about it, you and I, on this show for 6 months that, you know, the Tesla stock price ran up so much so fast that we wouldn't be surprised if it kind of stuck in a range. And we were thinking like 400 to 800, but it's really been between 600 and 700 most of this time, you know, 550 and 750, I guess. It doesn't surprise me. Like, you know, the business, it could be in this range for a while. You know, like I think a lot of people assume the business is correlated to the stock, you know, year by year. And maybe that's the case for some like stocks, like dividend paying stocks that are already mature, you know, but for growth tech stocks, especially, you know, I feel like the stock and the business underlying business are very uncorrelated, you know, unless you zoom out over like 10 years, then you can kind of see a correlation to it maybe. But you know, like we saw from 2014 to 2019, right? Tesla's business is growing very fast, even those years, but the stock just languished for a long time, you know? And so who knows? I mean, a $600 billion market cap, that's pretty big. It's a top, one of the top companies in the world already, right? And so to be over $1 trillion market cap, you know, for the stock to get over 1,000+, like, you know, I could see that taking another couple of years. You know, it's possible, you know, especially if full self-driving doesn't really come to fruition as quick as a lot of people think, you know? So yeah, I mean, the business is great. I'm very confident, very conviction that the business is going to keep growing. And I still really believe that Tesla will be the biggest company by market cap in the world by the end of the decade. That's like 9 years, you know, 9 years away. So it could be, hopefully it'll be much sooner. You know, that's like kind of my conservative, you know, expectation, but maybe it'll be in 3, 4, or 5 years, it'll be like a $2 trillion market cap company. Maybe next year, you know, that's possible. I would love that, but I don't expect that at all. So yeah, people have to be careful with the option stuff that I, you know, so many people saw us, me do last year, you know, and a lot of people did successfully last year, not just me, but you see so many people still trying to do that, catch these waves with call options. And, you know, hopefully it works, but, you know, it's much more risky at this point to do something like that. I think owning the shares is very safe long term and will be very well rewarded, you know, but yeah, it's too hard to know what's going to happen in the next 1 or 2 years. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, we might not ever get the same option opportunity that we had, you know, a couple years ago, just because it was so underrated or undervalued as a stock. And now that it's like a S&P 500, you know, mega cap company, you might not have that same reaction ever again. Part of me thinks the culture of investing and financial markets, et cetera, is so focused on your yearly return, like, you know, growth. And if you have a stock that doesn't perform well that year or it goes down that year, it's like the whole idea is why hold it, you know, if it's not going up for that year. But to me, it's like, I don't know how you could completely predict that year over year, like for volatile growth stocks like Tesla. It just seems like, you know, I don't know if focusing on this year or, you know, the immediate returns is the right way. It just feels like take a step back, take a 5-year view and relax a bit, you know, and as long as the company is executing toward ambitious goals, then just be happy, you know, and I kind of take that approach. You know, I'm happy, you know, Tesla at $400, Tesla at $800 or whatever, you know, because ultimately, like, the stock price will trail, eventually reflect, you know, I think in certain degree, certain extent, the value of the company as they continue to execute. So, but I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's easy for me to say that because, you know, I was able to get in early. I have a low cost basis, so I'm not in the red. Yeah. You know, when you're in the red, you know, it's much more painful, obviously. But I don't know.
It's true.
Yeah. But again, I think in some ways, what helps me also is if Tesla tanks a lot, let's say it goes under 400, like I have kind of more of a idea, like I know what, I have some ideas what to do, like, you know, oh, I can leverage up, you know, as long as the business execution is going well, it's an opportunity in some ways to actually accelerate returns.
That's right.
Yeah. And it might not be my full portfolio. I might sell, let's say, as it goes down, you know, I don't know, 20%, you know, 25%. Gradually switch them over to options,
long-term,
right?
Options.
Long term, long dated, 2 years out or something, you know, and do it gradually over time to accelerate returns, and that would be great, actually, you know, if the company is still executing. The big question though is if the company stops executing or if there's big problems, you know, then we're all, I wouldn't say we're all messed up, but that's the situation to be concerned about. To me, the stock price going up and down, that's not concerning at all, you know? And if people are getting sidetracked and are concerned about that, then I think that's the wrong focus. I don't know. It just seems like the focus should be on the execution, you know, the actual business of the company, which up until right now, I think is doing fine.
Absolutely. And the product, as long as the product and execution are superior, you know, the product is the most important in execution of, you know, managing the supply and building it, obviously, you know, so those go hand in hand. So as long as we've seen with this Plaid unveiling and the Model Y success, you know, the product is incredible. And so I don't see that changing.
Yeah. Do you think Tesla should do a stock split anytime soon?
I don't think they need to. I know some people think, you know, I've seen people talking about it or mentioning it. You know, it depends on what I think Elon wants to do. You know, he's kind of an independent thinker. And so if he thought the stock split, you know, remember he tweeted like a little over a year ago, like Tesla stock is too high. Do you remember he said that?
Yeah.
He said that, right? And I feel like in retrospect, that was kind of like maybe a riddle that they're going to do a stock. It's too high. They need to split it, you know, like not too high that he wants it to go down, you know, like maybe it was sort of like, you know, that. And if that's the case, you know, the stock then was like $700, $800, like around that range, right? And so maybe he does think, you know, when this one share costs more than, you know, $700 or $1,000, that's too much. And he wants it to be, you know, a fifth of that or a quarter of that so that, you know, more people can own at least one share of Tesla. So I wonder if that's the case. And if that's the case, I would see him staying in that mindset and potentially doing another split if we get close to 1,000 a share, if it goes up again more. So, but I don't think they need to.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of prefer if they kind of wait a bit. I mean, I'm not a big proponent either way, but I think, I think they kind of need more momentum. There's something about, I think, stock splits where it's messaging or signaling from the management that you're bullish on not just like long-term, but you're bullish on the next kind of short, medium term in terms of catalysts and enough momentum where you think that your stock price is going to rise, right? And I think like you need to deliver. I think, you know, if you're going to split your stock like shortly after you just split your stock, you know, last year, then you really have to have things lined up. And I don't think we have those things lined up as a company until I think Austin and Berlin get online. And then once we're producing, you know, more than expected, then I think, you know, you might see kind of a whole different attitude, I think, you know, toward Tesla.
How long do you think it'll take Berlin and Austin to kind of ramp up production? You know, like I think they're hoping to be producing a little bit in both those factories by the end of this year, right? But how long do you, what's your thoughts on how long it takes to ramp to like, you know, a meaningful, very meaningful amount of production?
Yeah, I think, sure. I mean, they've shown in Shanghai that they can ramp fast.
Yeah, it's China. Yeah. But do you think they can do that in Berlin especially, or maybe Tesla, Giga, Austin maybe? But
they have a different approach, I think, than obviously Fremont or the earlier factories. But I think they can ramp fast, but I think their suppliers are all on board because the Model Y isn't a new car. So we're not talking about, I mean, Cybertruck is, but Model Y is just existing suppliers. So you just tell them, double your production, you know? They don't have to go through new designs and, you know, new product checks and all this stuff, engineering. Mm-hmm. It's just a simple doubling. And the big thing is obviously the 4680 cells. As long as they could, you know, crack that problem, then I think they can ramp as fast as they can or they want. But yeah, I don't know. I'm not seeing much visibility on the 4680 situation. I don't know, you know, if they're ahead of schedule, behind, or on time. But yeah, I mean, it seems like, you know, they're wanting to start production by the end of the year. But I mean, you and I, we've seen this over the years many times where Tesla will have a timeline goal, and oftentimes that doesn't really tell what's really going on behind the scenes. You know, because they could be having a ton of problems, but they won't let people know that they're having all those problems, you know? They're going to keep... Yeah. I mean, there's that one Model X event. Do you remember we went to that a while? I think it was 2000...
Yeah.
I don't know, 15 or 15. Somewhere. And the doors were just not working on all of the demo cars, and they couldn't open them or close them. And all of these cars just had broken doors, you know? It was the craziest event. Yeah. And they're still saying, oh, we're going to ship them, you know, quickly, but then it's like
that.
Their doors don't even work, you know? And it's like
they had some lawsuit with the original supplier of the doors, and they developed it themselves instead of having some other firm design them or something.
But I mean, that's one thing. I mean, sometimes, you know, they'll stick to the timeline, hoping that they can maybe fix something behind the scenes, which is really difficult. Who knows? I mean, I think a lot of it's going to depend, though, on battery cells.
The timeline. Yeah, like, I mean, I was just talking about the full self-driving timeline with some people.
Yeah.
And it reminds me of Zeno's paradox. Are you familiar with Zeno's paradox?
No.
Uh-huh. It's like this mathematician. The simplified version is like, all right, if the wall is 6 feet away from me and I step halfway there, I'm 3 feet away. Then I step halfway there, I'm a foot and a half. Step halfway, I'm a 3/4. Keep going halfway there. You'll never actually get there, though. So it's like a timeline version of that, the full self-driving. It's like, all right, we're almost there. Now we're even closer. We're even closer. And it's like, we're never going to get there. It kind of feels like that. So I hope, I can't wait to break through and actually get there, you know, with this – you know, subscription model, hopefully, now I think it's being pushed, you know, is like July or something. So probably in first week of July, like end of July, and they'll be like August 1st, and I'll be like August 2nd. No, it's going to never end.
That Zeno's paradox, is it? That sounds like exactly full self-driving. That explains it, like, oh my gosh, that's crazy. Always like, you know, halfway there and halfway there, but ever so close, you know.
Yes, you just never quite get there, though.
Yeah, exactly. PR, do you think Tesla needs a PR team, or, you know, like, do they need to engage with journalists? Like, what are your thoughts on this?
They probably don't need it, but it would definitely help, you know, medium, short term, I think. You know, long term, it might not make much of a difference. The product is going to win out in the long run. And their product will probably stay superior for many years to come. But I think medium and short term, I think it would certainly help. You know, there's just a lot of misinformation out there. I've seen some memes. I think Elon liked or tweeted a meme or something about explaining how, like, even when they do try to do PR, then it like makes it even worse, the misinformation.
Yeah, yeah.
Just exacerbates the problem. So there's some truth to that too. Yeah. But I think it could still be done well. Like, you know, maybe Tesla could just be more active in their, they can create a PR Twitter handle, like an official Twitter handle everyone could see. So it's not like an email that only one reporter emails and then that person replies back to one reporter. No one sees except that reporter. It's like inefficient communication. Why not open source it with like a Tesla Twitter PR that everyone sees and has full transparency on. So any reporter that wants to like write at Tesla PR, at Tesla PR can choose like, oh, this is a reporter, I'll respond to them and everyone will see it. You know, I think that'd be kind of cool.
Yeah. I think like, you know, Tesla could use like, you know, back in the day, 2012, 2013, they had George Blankenship, vice president of sales and service. And then Jerome Guillen, I think 2014, 15 also played a role like that. He was like emailing, you know, customers back, and he was on the forums, people would reply, etc., with his replies. Yeah. But it seems like if Tesla had kind of like a, I don't know what you call it, maybe VP of sales and service or something, who was given permission to take over that Twitter handle or something and actually interact with customers and, you know, fix problems and do stuff, like that would be, I think, a net positive. I think that would be great.
Absolutely.
You know, but on the flip side, I think I've kind of grown or changed in my expectations of Elon and Tesla, where, you know, a few years ago I was like thinking they really need, you know, better PR, they need better marketing, they need better just like taking control of the narrative, all that stuff. But then like I realized like there's certain things that motivate Elon a lot, and part of it is like he kind of has this like, I don't know what it is, like stick it to the man, like kind of this rebellious, he'll do it a different way. And one of the things is like, I think he really is motivated by making the product so good that they don't need to do paid advertising or talk to journalists, right? Like that's part of his motivation to like, and I think like 99 out of 100 times that doesn't work, or even 999 times out of 1,000 times that never works, basically, almost right. And once in a blue moon, right? If you have some special person and special teams or whatever, maybe you have a slight possibility of that working. But that's what seems to be happening right now, is that somehow, like, I never expected the year to be 2021 and for Tesla still not to do any paid advertising. I thought demand would slow down to the point where they would have to, you know, without the paid advertising. But I'm thinking like, you made it this far without paid advertising. And if somehow you get motivated by like not doing paid advertising and it makes you try to make the product even that much better, you know, then more power to you.
Just have a superior product technology all the time, because it's like you have a handicap of no marketing.
Exactly.
Paid advertising. I mean, you have marketing. It's just organic grassroots marketing, all of us, which is the best marketing possible, word of mouth and all that. So they have great marketing in that respect, but they don't show up on commercials or advertisements or PR lacking. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
I think, you know what I think is the Trojan horse for all of us was sort of the Model Y, you know, like they didn't want to increase expectations on the Model Y. They were just kind of down. They revealed it, but it was like, they didn't make a big deal of it because they didn't want to cannibalize Model 3 at the time. And all this Model 3 was a great product as it was, but this Model Y, you know, for the value is so amazing that, you know, you can buy this Model Y for that price and get that value, that range, that performance, that technology, everything. That's the Trojan horse that Tesla put in the industry, I think, and it's taking over. And you can see it in all the continents. The demand is off the hooks. They're going to export to Europe, building it primarily in Europe and Texas. You know, just huge demand for this thing.
Yeah, I mean, especially like if you bring down the price and increase the range. So if you have a standard range Model Y for under 40,000 that goes like close to 300 miles, let's say, you know, with the new 4680 cells. Like, that's insane, you know? It's like, why, who wouldn't get, you know, a Model Y in that price range, right? And then
you have the crack credit now, the 10,000.
Yeah, if you get that tax credit, then it's like, oh my gosh.
Game over, for sure, in the US.
Yeah, there's no end to demand, you know? And that's where I'm like, you know, paid advertising, I don't care. I mean, like, if you don't need it, then, you know, that's fine, you know, more power to Tesla, I think.
A friend and I were just chatting about in California here. You just see Teslas everywhere, Model Ys, especially now, just all over the place. Lots of Model 3s, Model Xs, you know, and some Model Ss too still. But it kind of reminds us of like, you know, 15 or 20 years ago when the Prius first came out. And in California, suddenly there was a whole bunch of Priuses, and it was just like a precursor to the rest of the country then getting a ton of Priuses. And I think the same thing's happening with the Teslas. Like in California, you're seeing so many of them. It's like, I'll be at my school, like picking up kids in the Bay Area, and like literally half the cars are Teslas, like at school, like pulling into pick up kids, or in the highway. I'll be in the highway and suddenly I look around me, every single car next to me, except for like one, is a Tesla. I'm like, what the heck? Yeah. I wonder if anyone noticed I'm plaid, I'm different, you know, and some of them do, you know, but it's like crazy. It's just, I think the rest of the country is catching up to this, and it'll be just incredible, the changeover.
I noticed, California is crazy. I've you know, been back in California for the past week, and so seeing all these like Model 3s and Model Ys all around, it's like crazy. Like in Austin, it wasn't really like that. It was like here and there, you know, but California is different level for sure.
And I see all kinds of people, like, you know, lots of really like even old people that I'm like, what is this person doing with that technology? But there's like a 90-year-old people driving the Model 3 or Model Y, and just, it's insane. Like everyone's getting them.
So I got a few comments from people asking like for me to ask you if you've purchased Dogecoin or not. Have you?
I did sign up for a Robinhood account and bought, you know, a really small amount, in there relative to, you know, my portfolio of Bitcoin, for example. It's, you know, I have some Bitcoin that I've had for many years. It's funny when I talk about Bitcoin on Twitter, like everyone's throwing out these books at me, like, you should study it more. You should, I just don't even reply. It's like people, they just assume like I'm new to Bitcoin.
Well,
the
big like Bitcoin, I wouldn't say meme, but response is if you don't buy into, if you're not a Bitcoin bull, right, maximalist, then you don't get it. You don't understand.
You don't get it.
That's the meme or the rationale.
It's kind of scary, and that whole thing is scary. It's serious, but it's scary. It's like, definitely feels cultish. Yeah. So, I did get some Dogecoin. I think I'm gonna get more if it goes down. I'll buy some more. I've considered. I really like Ethereum. I don't own any Ethereum. Mm-hmm. I would like to diversify the Bitcoin to some Ethereum, to be honest. I think you have like the guy Vitalik Buterin as kind of like a central leader, you know, so it's not just some like out of control ship that's going into the sea that Bitcoin is, that no one can stop. It's just going to go in the direction it's going. And if it turns out to be some crazy energy issue, then no one's going to be able to stop it, and so that's kind of scary to me. Versus you have Ethereum and this like this guy that's kind of the head of it. I'm not sure exactly how they get changes done, but he's clearly coordinating a lot of improvements to Ethereum, and I like that a lot. I listened to that last interview he did with Lex Fridman, for example, and it's been in the it's been there for a long time. Ethereum is like, right behind Bitcoin in terms of market capitalization, and there's functionality to it, more than just store of value, and so that's appealing. And yeah, so I'd like to diversify, I think, but I'm just not ready for, I've already had some tax pain. I've had to pay a ton of taxes from last year and this year, and like selling Bitcoin is just going to generate tons of I have to be ready for that, and so I have
That's
to be
true.
really serious about making that transition.
Yeah. I'm curious with all your taxes, I kind of remember, I'm not even sure if I remember, but it seems like taxes weren't a big deal or a big priority slash consideration in your investment decisions, like let's say a couple of years ago. But after having the year that you did have last year and paying all the federal and state taxes that you did pay, did you learn a lot about taxes, and has that changed your mind at all, where you're a bit more kind of, sensitive, or does that enter your thought process, with your investment decisions a bit more?
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I live in California. You have that 16% tax, and then you have the federal highest rate tax, and so you're losing, more than half
Wait, it's 13.
your
It's 13.3, right? Not 16 yet, right?
I thought it was going up to 16% this
Okay.
year. I thought
Well, I think they're
maybe I'm
still
wrong.
debating, but yeah, we'll see.
Oh, maybe. Okay. Well, I think my accountants are like earmarking it on
Oh,
my
wow.
so far for realized gains. Maybe I'm wrong, but I thought it was overall when you add it with like the all the other. It seems like it's a huge amount. Every time I sell something to pay my taxes, then I generate enormous new gains. I then have to figure out how to pay taxes on those gains, and so it's just it just is a lot more than it's hard to swallow because the money is not efficiently used versus like if I was giving it away, out of my foundation. You just know when you even though the government is giving away money for child tax credit recently or whatnot, it's like for every dollar you give the government, maybe 10 cents is going back to the people with that child tax credit, but 90 cents of it is going to be, in my mind, wasted on a lot of crazy red tape bureaucracy stuff, that it just doesn't make sense to spend it on, so I would much rather give that dollar to charities directly, where that I think are most impactful, so I'm trying to be sensitive to maximizing the money I want to give away in a way that also reduces my taxes, but I'm still paying a lot of taxes, so.
I mean, so there's talk, of Biden getting rid of the capital gains rate for those making a million or higher. Who knows? It might be just a compromised rate at the end. But if they actually get rid of that and you have to pay income taxes on your capital gains, that would boost your tax rate to 39% or so, plus the 3.8, like Medicare surtax, so almost 43%, plus 13,
Six
or
or
maybe
sixteen,
16, but let's say it's
yeah,
13, so that's
okay,
56% off of long-term gains. That's like crazy. Almost 60% off of long-term, stock. Like that would, I mean, that's like, that makes me like scratch my head. Like,
stock that we have close to zero cost basis on. It's not like stock we have like we took 10%, so it's like 60% of our portfolio is just going to
I
taxes,
mean,
basically.
the question that comes up is like, why hold long term then? I'm saying it reduces the incentive to hold long term if you're paying the same as if you could trade. I think I mean, the reality is like, I think because of the long term capital gains tax rate, you're willing to incur certain additional long term risks because of that favorable tax rate. But if you're not, then if you get the same tax, if there's no benefit to holding, then I don't know. It feels like people would just trade a lot more. I mean, it just seems, long-term investments, even venture capital, I kind of wonder, you know, if they have to pay, everyone has to pay like over 50% on all your gains. So I think it changes the equation. So I don't know. I'm watching this closely. I think it'll be a bad move if they go up to 40, whatever percent.
Long-term
holding. Yeah.
Yeah. They should keep long-term holding incentivized by letting you have long-term gains for sure.
Yeah. I'm okay with maybe like boosting it from 20 to 25%, maybe 28.
Yeah.
But man, it's like, you gotta be sensitive to the dynamics. I mean, another thing is like, you know, entrepreneurs, you know, the next Elon Musk is choosing, let's say, what country to build their next company in. And, you know, if the country doesn't have decent tax rates, I mean, it doesn't have to be perfect, but if you're going to take 55% or whatever, you know, or something, 50% of your long-term, you know, stock, then I think you question as an entrepreneur whether that country is the right thing. And then the venture capitals also start to question. They all start to migrate to a certain locality, like whether it's
Singapore or some
other country or region. And there's just, within a couple of years, you have this crazy hub that just forms, you know? And you wonder, why isn't the next great company being made in the US anymore? And this stuff, I think it does matter in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Curious. I wanted to get your input on kind of any personal struggles with your financial situation that's changed over the past year. Mm-hmm. I shared on my channel last Sunday about some.
I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. Some kind of wealth struggles that someone labeled it in a Twitter reply to me after the live stream, my crisis of wealth. And I thought that was, you know, appropriate in a sense, because I'm feeling in different ways where more and more disconnected, you know, from the realities of life without a lot of, let's say, wealth and resources. And I feel a lot of ways like resources, I don't know. I'd love to hear your side on this, but it kind of makes me, I think, in a way, a bit lazy. I take these shortcuts where if it can be solved with money, then I do it with money, because it does, like, money doesn't mean that much to me in terms of, because the resources are growing, I can't use them all anyways, you know? It's just like, so if I could save time or fix a problem with just money, and it's like, okay, just do it, forget it, you know, I don't even care, you know, it's like price tags are irrelevant in some in some ways, you know, just fix it, get it done. And I feel like it's kind of, in a way, an over-reliance on just this quick fix of always having to go to this rather than struggling through like issues and problems. Feeling the common experience of scarcity and using, you know, I don't know. It's just, I feel a bit detached and I wasn't expecting this actually. But I'm curious, do you have any kind of, am I alone in this, or do you have any like,
no, you're not alone at all. Any, yeah, no, it's,
ideas.
It's absolutely. I mean, I think, in the fall of last year, I had a good friend of mine from my previous job who, you know, manages ultra high net worth, clients, you know, in tax efficient ways, portfolios, you know, he's a good friend of mine, and, you know, he knew what was going on with my net worth change. And he offered, he said, hey, I can put you in touch with some people that are, you know, had, you know, are a couple of them maybe that had extreme wealth changes, and a couple of people that just have lived their life with, you know, wealth and the level you're at now. And maybe it's worth you chatting with them just to kind of adjust how to live your life, you know? And I took them up on that, and I was like, I think that'd be a good idea. And so I reached out and talked to a few guys, you know, in situations, some have family, some came upon, but you know, they're good examples that the friend of mine put me in touch with to kind of guide me on what to watch out for, things to be conscious of, or how you're going to live your life differently now. And, you know, and it was really helpful to me to go through those exercises with those people to talk about things and make sure you realize how grateful you are to have what you have, and stay charitable or teach, raise your kids in this type of, we didn't have a lot of money, how to be sensitive to that. And there's a lot of challenges, you know, and there's like a curse with people who win the lottery. You know, most people who win the lottery don't have that benefit of that coaching, so to speak, of how to handle, you know, their families. You know, people who grow up with wealth, maybe they have some benefit because they have like coaching from their parents or parents' parents, you know, in some ways. But if you win a lottery and you know, you've only been in, you know, around people that, you know, middle class or lower class people all your life, and suddenly you're like super wealthy, it's like a curse. And people like that end up depressed or suicidal or drug addicts, and they just run their life to oblivion pretty quickly. It's like a bad thing. So it can be, it can go that direction very easily for a lot of people. So I've been careful and tried to stay conscious of that. It helps me that I don't drink or do any recreational drugs or anything like that. I feel like if I was, you know, doing that stuff, I'd probably do a lot more of that with more free time or something like that, you know? And so I like to focus on positive things like health or investing still, or being, you know, figuring out new ways to be charitable with some of the wealth I have, you know, things like that. And family, I like to focus on my family a lot. My kids growing up now, raising them. So I have more time to do that stuff that I want to do now. That's what I've been able to use my wealth for, like doing less of working for a 9-to-5 job of stuff I don't, you know, I don't have to do anymore.
Yeah. Yesterday I was realizing that I think one of the reasons why this is hitting me so hard is because I've actually worked really hard the past maybe 10, 15 years to try to get close to kind of this sense of equality slash, I don't say equality, but I've made a lot of decisions to be like normal or average in terms of economic status. And one example is my wife and I, we have a bunch of friends and family in LA area, and there's some nice areas in LA, et cetera. But we actually made this conscious decision to leave LA and to go out to kind of like a boondock, just, you know, small town, small city out there that isn't very, that's like, people are like, why are you living there? It's just like a no, this is just a way out there. We went out there because we're like, hey, this place actually has a lot of like harmony or equality with people. There isn't as much divide. Like in a big city, you have like, you know, you have the poor and the rich, and there's like these clear distinctions. But like we moved out there because it's like, you know, it's just so just, I don't know what you call it. So blah or normal, you know, of an existence. And by living out there in just a very just normal house, I felt very close to the middle class of America, not even upper, just like really just working middle class, actually, just like, and even blue collar folks, like neighbors that, you know, plumber, electrician here, just like different people, just working class people, just on my street. Half the houses have trucks, you know, where they're actually using their trucks, you know, for work and stuff. And living in a neighborhood like that for 10 years, I'm like, oh, I feel part of like, you know, the working like experience, you know, the working class of America. And I understand those struggles, and I, you know, have friends. I'm living in the same neighborhood. And I didn't realize how important that was to me. But, you know, those are decisions we made. And then in the past 6 months, right, we moved to Austin. We ended up, you know, getting a place at a nicer kind of a much nicer area than they were previously living in California. And then we kept our California house because we have friends and family we need to see often. And I want a studio that's already, you know, done. And so I'm like, okay, we'll just keep it. And so now we have like, you know, multiple residences, and we have this like nice RV too. And now I'm just so confused because I'm like, I'm at this place where I'm like, now my living is not relatable. You know, I have these empty houses, you know, and then a nice, you know, living in a nicer neighborhood now. And I'm growing, and the finances are growing where I'm feeling more and more detached from the middle working class, you know, kind of population that I've prioritized as such a high priority for so many years to be close with. And so I've entered kind of a crisis, you know, where I'm like, man,
this it's like an identity crisis.
Yeah, this is rough, man. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure some people will be like, oh, you know, pity Dave, or, you know, that struggle. But for me, it's not.
It's an issue.
Yeah. It's more of a character issue where I don't know if that's the type of person I want to be, where I'm like, I'm detached from the realities of a working class, you know, America.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the first step is being aware of all this, right? And being conscious of it, you know. So you're doing the first step in accepting that, like, hey, there is an identity change potentially going on here. I don't want to lose, you know, what I was or how I was before this. And I'm always going to stay empathetic as much as possible to that entire class that I was a part of, you know, and identify with that as much as possible. And so I think if you can stay very conscious of that all the time, I think you can really do a lot of good, even, you know, living the way you are now, or even more, you know, quote unquote, luxuriously. And if you have another residence or bigger house or whatever, you could still do good. In terms of, like, you know, when you do interact with old neighbors or whatever, you know, just be generous and kind and you know, I don't know, doesn't mean giving them money, but like, hey, if one of them, your old neighbor, needs a fence to be rebuilt, be like, hey, I'll build the fence for us. You know, you don't have to pay. I'll just build it. You know, things like little things here and there, I think, can be really helpful.
Yeah.
If you had to work like you used to, maybe, then you might not be able to spend nearly as much time as you do now on this. Right. And so you're really doing a lot of good, right? Because you have more free time to do stuff, you know? And so you could lever up that free time to do even more of what you want to do, or add a new thing to that, a new category, or, you know, so, you know, it's, you have to balance it, but at the same time, you want to keep yourself disciplined and don't want to become like some freewheeling, like, money doesn't matter, I'll spend it on anything. You know, you don't want to be that person either, you know? So it's a juggling act, I guess. Yeah. That's all I would think, but I can appreciate the concerns you have, and it definitely changes us. And it's like, whether you embrace it or not, you can embrace it or you can kind of deny it. And if you embrace it, it could backfire too and turn you into kind of like a spoiled brat type person, you know?
Yeah. I was so confident that I thought money wouldn't change me for the worse. I was like, you know, 100%, like, you know, I'm grounded, whatever. And recently, I'm like, I don't know. I feel like it's
not changing for the worst. I might see something here and there, but look at what you're doing with this channel. Like, this channel is magnified to hundreds of thousands of people, like, that are liking it and getting a lot out of it. You know, like,
it's
overall way better.
Yeah, I don't know, but it just feels. Yeah, I mean, we'll see. I mean,
it's a struggle.
It's a struggle.
It's it's a philosophical, ethical dilemma in a lot of ways.
Definitely. All right, man, on that sober note, we'll go ahead and wrap up things. Did you have anything else on your mind, or?
No, I mean, I think, what else were we going to, nothing else. I think that's good.
All right, man. Have a great week. We'll definitely keep in touch, and take care, man. All right. See you later. Bye. Later.